But I've got no intention of facing this sober. Hello, and welcome to episode 177 of Ribbon of Memes, a podcast where we interrogate films previously described by other fearless warriors as masterpieces.
Or at least pretty good.
yes. I am Nick. I am the... What am I? The princess of this film. And I am joined, as ever, by Roger.
Who... Only other role he's known for is as a dirty cop, but never mind.
We are discussing the 1984 cult classic, maybe?
I think that's fair.
Yeah, okay. The Ice Pirates, directed by Stuart Raphael. And this, you know, we've been talking in our last episode about a classic sort of Disney look. This, to me, has a very specific sort of classic post-Star Wars, early to mid-80s science fiction film look to it.
I think very crucially post-Alien as well, because that was the one that really brought in the, rather than the clean environment that you'd see in something like, remember when we talked about Silent Running?
Yes.
Yeah, we've got this spaceship with everything very much in its place, and it doesn't look lived in at all, even though the people living in it are slobs. Whereas here we've got the grungy metal grid work, dirty
abandoned used warehouse kind of that kind of aesthetic, yeah, post Alien, post Star Wars, kind of a lived in universe and very lived in to the point where no one cleans anything at all and everything's oily and dirty. But this is a, you know, there are a stream of films like Space Hunter Beyond the Forbidden Zone and
we're going to have to do that eventually, aren't we?
We are going to have to do that. The Last Starfighter, maybe, though that's slightly more Disney-esque than this. This is more like a Hell Comes to Frogtown. These kind of maybe adolescent might be a better way of putting it.
Yeah.
But grown-up lived in, tongue-in-cheek, over-the-top science fiction films. For which this, to me, is the pinnacle in my memory. The Ice Pirates I saw once many years ago and loved it, and I've never wanted to watch it since. And I, funnily enough, a number of our friends have said exactly the same thing, that they didn't want to spoil the memory of it because they thought, they had a sneaking suspicion it was crap, but they loved it at the time.
I gotta say, I still love it.
Right out the bat, I was surprised that this... well, two things could be true at once.
Yeah.
It may well be that this is a crap film. But again, I loved it.
I found this originally more or less by mistake. It would have been sometime in the mid to late 80s. I was recording a lot of films off TV, onto VHS cassette, looking up kids. and... I would quite often record something just because it sounded vaguely interesting and it was on late. Then I would watch it later and decide whether to keep it or not. And this was pretty much all I knew about it was the title, and it sounded vaguely interesting. So, and yeah, this is really fun.
For me, this would be a classic video shop score in that there was a video shop just down the road. This was before Blockbuster. It was just a local video shop, and they'd have a section for like this kind of cheesy 80s science fiction films, and you know, picked it up, and I suspect that's how, either your way or my, that's how a lot of people devoured this of our age, rather than watching in the cinema. I suspect it's got an almost Roger Corman feel to it a bit as well, in that it's cheaply done, but done well enough that it doesn't look cheaply done.
Yeah, I think it did actually get a cinema release. I haven't found any details of that.
Yes, I wonder if that was in the UK. I don't know. I certainly know of no one who saw it in the cinema, but that's not a surprise. I think hence the term cult classic, I suppose.
Yeah, but we our star here is Robert Urich, who, yeah, he was quite big in TV, but only three films, and one of them was one of the dodgy cops in Magnum Force.
Oh, Magnum Force, gosh, I've seen that as well, a long time ago.
And the other one, I can't even remember what it's called now. It's certainly not one that was notable.
No, he didn't. This didn't launch his career, which in a way is a shame because he's exactly who he needs to be for this. I mean, so
it didn't launch anybody's career, but some of them had their careers launched anyway.
The tone of the film is very much, I don't know, kind of Crimson Pirate, kind of Pirates of the Caribbean. I mean, there's a clue in the name.
It's the thing we've talked about before, most recently about Condor Man last episode, of they are making fun of it, but they are making fun of a thing they love rather than a thing they have contempt for.
Yes. It's one of those films that is, it's close enough to the actual thing that it's not quite clear whether it's a parody or they're just doing a film and doing it tongue in cheek, or it's sort of in that space between the two, really.
It came to its current form in two steps, because there was a script by Sanford Sherman, who had written Krull, called The Water Planet.
Another one of that. That's the whole 80s fantasy genre.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
And he sold it to MGM. But MGM were in trouble financially, so they asked Raffel to see, could you make a cheaper version of it? And so Raffel said, yeah, okay, but I'm going to have to rewrite it and make it more comical. So it started off as
over the cracks.
Yeah, but also it started off as a serious science fiction script. I think that's worth bearing in mind.
Oh, so it's sort of parodying itself in a way. Well, I think that was a genius move, because what saved this film from being actually crap is its sense of humour, I think.
Yeah. It's interesting. It's clearly not done on the cheap, but there are times when it looks it.
It wins me
over fairly early on, because what it's not doing, in spite of what we were saying, is ripping off Star Wars. It doesn't have the Star Wars look. What it is ripping off is classic pirate films. So, yeah, we have the swinging on a rope across the cargo hold.
Yes, and everyone uses sabres and cutlasses, and we have these bizarre robot characters. It has the sensibility of swashbuckling. And Robert Urich, it's a shame he didn't do so much more, because I think he's perfect. Much as Cary Elwes is perfect in The Princess Bride for what he does, I think Robert Urich here is absolutely great as a kind of Burt Lancaster-esque Crimson Pirate. In fact, I kind of prefer him here to Burt. He's got that, he just never takes anything too seriously. He's got the perfect wisecrack for everything. But he's not irritating. He's just endearing.
But at the same time, when he's in danger, you get the feeling that he realises he's in danger, but he's still going to keep wisecracking till the end, because what else are you going to do?
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah, that's a hard, I imagine, a hard style to hit right and not to come off as quite an irritating twat. But he does it. And then we have Robert Urich, and we have his kind of first mate, or whatever you call him, which is Michael D. Roberts, who I think it's Roscoe, but I've never seen him in anything else that I recall. But those two have a lovely relationship, the two of them. That's kind of, they've clearly done a lot of things together, and they've seen a lot, and they love each other, and they're sick of each other, and it's very well done.
Yeah. Roberts was in quite a bit of stuff. Ice Pirates is fairly early for him. He has a small part in Rain Man. A lot of films, but mostly quite small films. Lots of TV guest appearances, that kind of thing.
And then the surprise characters here, who I did not remember at all, Angelica Houston and Ron Perlman are both in this film.
Yeah, this is Angelica Houston in her very brief period between deciding she wants to act and being recognised as a serious actress that everybody should take seriously, because the year after this, she was in Pritzi's Honour, which was her breakout role.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes.
And I imagine she doesn't talk about this a whole lot.
It's a shame because she's very good. She's kind of a Valkyrie warrior woman in this.
And as we've said before, we're suckers for that.
Yeah, no problem with any. And Ron Perlman, it's interesting.
He really doesn't look like the Ron Perlman image.
No. So we're used to him being a kind of looming, tough, again, often kind of caring knight, but kind of a caring, funny giant is sort of the niche he follows now when he's not threatening.
As the main villain we meet here, he's pared down an ascetic and, you know, cut your arm on his cheekbones, that kind of look.
Yes.
This was his second film, incidentally, after Quest for Fire a few years earlier.
And then we have poor old John Carradine turning up as well, who we saw last in The Howling. I didn't realise how crippling his arthritis has been, but it's very clear he's got severe rheumatoid arthritis in his hands.
Yeah, he's in one scene and he lies down for all of it.
Yes. And he doesn't have much to do, and he does it.
But he is still John Carradine, so...
It's tricky to talk through the plot, because it's actually bizarrely convolutes. It packs an awful lot of, you know, there's alien parodies in there, there's like Tatooine-esque planet surfaces. Do you want to talk through the plot? Should we do it that way? It might be
well
worth it.
From a high level perspective, these guys are space pirates, and the thing that they steal is the most valuable commodity in the universe is ice. Because most of the water-bearing worlds were destroyed in the Big War, and only one world still has plentiful water, and it is run by the Templars. Boo hiss.
Boo, yeah, they're the bad. It's very they're very kind of medieval sci-fi.
Yeah, they wear chain coifs. Well, they're thugs do anyway, so you can tell who they are. There is no
particular
reason.
There's probably a good space reason for this.
Yeah. Charged particles protection. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. Bloody chainmail will get pretty cold in a vacuum. But anyway, I suppose most things get pretty cold in a vacuum, to be fair.
Oh, actually, cooling is the big problem in vacuum. But anyway. The opening sequence. We start with the big opening action sequence, which does set up most of the plot for the rest of the film. They're pirating this ice convoy, presumably taking the water from Mithra, the Temple of Worlds, to somewhere else that has paid for it.
It's also implied they're not kind of... They're fun pirates, you know. They're plucky rebels who sort of Robin Hood in the sense that they're redistributing it, but mostly they're in it for themselves, but not in a malevolent way.
Yeah, they're certainly not cruel. And while ravaging through this ship, they discover the Goyle in suspended animation.
Now, this bit, again, from modern sensibilities, is a bit tricky, as in, she's gorgeous, let's take her, you know, let's abduct her.
I think, to be fair, there is a certain sense of she is clearly going to be valuable to ransom.
Yes, yeah. Again, they're not cruel about it. There's no... aside from the fact that she is a possession, again, I think Robert Urich's charisma kind of pulls it off quite well here. And then when Mary Crosby wakes up as the princess, she's very much in the Princess Leia mold, almost like a carbon copy of Princess Leia, in that she is a pretty tough,
self-confident
character.
She knows what she
character.
Wants, and she is determined to get it. And if some scruffy nerf herder gets in the way, he's got to be put in his place.
Yes, exactly. So, again, we have a Han Leia dynamic between the two. It works. I mean, I think they're both great at it. It's nice to see even if it's a particular type of strong female character, which is leaning into sort of where Joss Whedon went in the end with Buffy. It's nice to have a strong female character rather than a scream queen.
Yeah, Mary Crosby, again, mostly had a TV career. This was probably the biggest film she was in. She's kind of sad.
It is sad. They're all on board for the kind of film that it is. They all get the tone absolutely spot on. They're all great at it.
But anyway, they get away with at least some ice and the princess. But they are pursued. They have to split up their ship and. Various things happen, and essentially, the two leads get captured.
Jason and Roscoe.
Yeah, we don't see what anybody else is up to at this point, but they presumably got away in different directions. We find out about that later.
Yeah, it does that cool kind of very 80s thing of the ship splitting into three kind of parts, like in Battle of the Planets. Oh, it's very cool. I enjoyed it. Anyway, they get taken to planet.
Round here we call it Gatchaman, stranger.
I'm sorry. I can imagine the Decadence bot from Futurama having a great time on the planet.
Well, we do actually have a pimp bot in this film.
Oh, yes, we do.
Whom I had forgotten, but yeah, he's there. Jason and Roscoe are going to get reconstructed.
I mean, this is the most ridiculous. Like, they're on a conveyor belt with these kind of choppy... It's just... I don't know why it works, because it shouldn't. It's just nuts. But they're lying on their backs.
I didn't think about the quantity of anticoagulant you would need to make that survivable.
Exactly. It's like, what if they catch the right... Maybe they don't care, but there would have been a lot of inadvertent urethrostomies performed by this. Anyway, let's not worry too much about the medical. The point is... this was written by guys, presumably, and the last thing you want to end up on is a conveyor belt with choppy things coming towards your nuts as a guy. So that's it's not subtle. It's visual storytelling of we have these crocodile clamps going to bite your balls off. But they don't. But plot twist, they are rescued. I don't think that happens to everyone. Most other people do get...
Yes, it's those two specifically because Princess Carina has decided that for her purposes, she can use these guys.
Yes.
I do like the line, you know, that they've had the technicians applying shaving foam and so on as they went along the conveyor belt, and the technician after the chopping saying to Roscoe, pretend it happened or it will.
Jason, he's still trying to chat up people while he's on the conveyor belt to being castrated, which is, I don't know. It is so, this is why it's gotta be, this was once a serious film with it. They really leaned into making it bonkers, but I don't know. It almost lost me there because it was almost a bit too far, but they carry it off well enough that it didn't lose me.
Again, both Urich and Roberts are, yeah, you know, they realize what's going to happen. They have no idea that they're going to be saved from it, and they are both effectively portraying, I am terrified, but I'm going to try to keep up the image.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that perfect kind of, I'm never going to, I might lose other things. They can't take my cool. It's just perfect. So then the princess, they are then taken to like the, it's kind of equivalent of a car shop, only it's for slaves. And the princess, and her maid, her older maid, buy them up.
Yeah. And so to go to the high level summary, her father was a famed explorer, and he had got a message back to her that suggested he had found the famous and generally regarded as mythical seventh water world, and then vanished.
Now, again, I think the implication here, or maybe it was supposed to happen at the end, is that that is Earth.
Yes. There was a sequence originally planned in which, I mean, yes, it is recognisably Earth from space as we see it at the end, but also
we do see it at the end.
Were originally going to have a shot with the ship flying over the beaches at Malibu.
Okay.
And then, but the studio cut it without telling the director.
I think maybe that was a good move. I think it ends again. I don't want to see the real world intrude into this.
I don't think saying this is contemporary Earth actually helps the story.
No. And in fact, it would pull me out of the story, even if it was right at the end. So I actually agree with the studio on that one.
But anyway, basically that is the rest of the film. They are trying to track down her father, and then once they get the information, they are trying to track down the mythical seventh world.
So yes, they escape with the aid of a character they met in prison. Oh, we had the prison sequence, didn't we? Killjoy, who was John Matuszak, who again I don't recall seeing in anything else.
Former pro football player.
Well, he can act better than what's his face in Airplane anyway. yeah, he's fun. Again, he's the sort of like more villainy pirate with fewer morals and less of a heart of gold, but still goes along for the adventure.
The year after this, he had a part in The Goonies.
Oh, did he? He wasn't one-eyed Willy, was he? That's
Lotney Sloth Fratelli, apparently. I've never seen The Goonies, so that means nothing to me, but it sounds like a villain name.
Goonies is, it's a stereotypical sort of 80s film that everyone thinks is a classic. It's actually not that great compared to a lot of the other films around at the time. Having watched it again, I thought that at the time when I watched it as a kid, and then I watched it again, probably a decade ago, and felt just the same. And so do my kids, incidentally, who also watched it and were not super impressed either. Anyway, that as an aside.
Yeah, and we get the bit with John Carradine. It is strongly implied that Carina is being allowed to escape because the Templars want to know where the Seventh World is as well.
Presumably so they can then either blow it up or take control and continue their monopoly of the water.
Yeah, presumably in this case they probably shouldn't have captured Karina's father, or maybe they didn't. There are bits that are never really explained.
No, we don't quite find out what happens to her, but it's that sort of film that... it's not quite fridge logic in the sense... It's not that it doesn't make sense, it's just that you aren't given all the details, but you don't really care because the film just... moves from one set piece to the next.
There is always a next goal to move on to.
Yes.
And on the way there is usually something silly happening. Like the clearly alien parody.
yes, the ship gets space herpes. Which is was not something I had remembered, but this basically involves the little chest burster from Alien running around the ship from time to time. Doesn't really do anything.
And bursting out of a turkey at the dinner table.
Yeah. I don't know why it works. It's so silly. But it's just a little joke they cram in, and they're briefly obsessed with it for 5 minutes, and then they're off to the pirate planet. Not the one from Doctor Who. The planet where the pirates go, the rebel, well, not really rebel base, the dissidents, the outcasts all go there. We have some, there we get, Angelica Houston's character's, moment, because they all get their odd moment, I think, and hers is, there's a surly guy in the outdoor bar or whatever it is, and he does the classic thing that I'd remembered. It's probably been in a lot of films where she chops someone's head off so quickly and so supremely that they don't realise that the head's been chopped off until they nod, and then their head falls off. Mm. Which it's stupid, but I don't know. I just constantly say, this is stupid, but it works. And here we have it again.
Yeah, and I think some of that is because they are not winking at the camera or whatever. To the characters, it is real.
Yes. But they're also, again, it's tricky because it's not quite Airplane. They're not playing it complete straight. But that's because their characters never do anything. Their characters just don't take anything seriously. But they're not...
Yeah, the character of Jason has a sense of humour.
Yes, but it's not like breaking the fourth wall sense of humour. That is tricky to do. But again, Princess Bride does it quite well as well, that kind of...
Oh, I should have mentioned that I was thinking at the time that a lot of the shots of the city looked like the 70s style of Logan's Run, and in fact some of them are the same shots in the city. So.
There you go, well spotted. So from there, the next set piece is to go to, they have to drive out with a space lettuce lady who, again, it was a bit... It has a feel very like, again, we're both role players, they're the kind of characters that you would play in role playing games as an adolescent. And it's the kind of gonzo story that just goes in lots of different directions.
But there's also the subverting the sexism thing, you know. Here are these ugly people over there who have the transport we need. Obviously, woman, you go over and vamp him. She comes back a few minutes later. he's a she and she's into you.
Yeah. And then he's clearly passed his charisma check or whatever. You know, there's a few carousing roles going here from Traveller. I don't know. I just feel very comfortable in this world because it's exactly the sort of tone we still aim for with that role play. And so, yes, they drive across this kind of Dune-esque, or more like Tatooine-esque planet now.
Also kind of Mad Max-y.
Well, yes, then it becomes kind of Mad Max-y. We have raiders in a big kind of Mad Max car.
If you're me, you also notice that a lot of the junk that's scattered around is clearly aircraft parts. So I assume they filmed this in an aircraft disposal yard somewhere.
Junk that most people would not recognise as anything specifically, but you, Roger, yes.
What can I say? I have a very particular set of skills.
So they're going there to find his ex-colleague, and then we get a bit of foreshadowing because, well, not colleague, friend, comrade-in-arms, whatever it is.
Karina's father's old comrade-in-arms, yeah.
Yes.
Who is now old.
He's now 20 years older than he was, but he knows... he's got some does he give them coordinates for the seventh planet? No, he knows where the father was last seen.
Yeah.
And so he gives them that. And then he's, killed by the raiders. And they head off. So again, it's really moving. Well, not moving, but it works.
But also here is a save the cat moment because, yeah, old buddy was on his own. In this settlement, it's described as a town, but he's the only guy there, even when they arrive. And he has a load of animals that he's looking after: a couple of donkeys, a couple of pigs, kind of thing. And although it's never space mentioned, donkey. They just casually take them on board the ship.
Yeah, and then they're not just then they're characters for the rest of or background characters for the rest of the film. Yeah, that's true. Again, this film really works if your characters, like Han Solo, have a heart of gold hidden deep. Not hidden that deep in this case, but yeah. And again, we talked in our last episode about how I felt there was pretty much zero chemistry between Michael Crawford and Barbara Carrera. Here, they're a good sparring partner. Mary Crosby and Robert Urich, they just have a nice relationship. I'm quite happy for them to get it together. You know they will. They know they will. They're just sort of playing with it. Yeah, it works for me. I'm liking this film more the more I talk about it, and I enjoyed it a lot watching it.
So the next step is to go on and find Dad. Except it this turned out to be false information.
Yes, it's actually a sort of mystical...
Basically, the planet is where the Templars put their problem child to not be a nuisance back in civilization. So he has set himself up with an army of warrior women and so on.
As you do. I mean, it's that sort of film. But he is he's a severed head, but he can be attached to other bodies somehow. Mm-hmm. This bit didn't. I think maybe this was just one a bit too far. I didn't find his character massively endearing.
I think we've met too many man children in the real world.
Yes, yeah. Wenden, Bruce Vilanch, and it's just again we're carried along because we have our leads with us who I'm enjoying. But it was just perhaps I could have been quite happy with skipping this whole section. It just doesn't quite land for me in the way the rest of it does. So that, I suppose that's my one slightly negative thing. I found him quite irritating,
So they find Dad, but apparently Dad's been replaced by a robot for reasons.
Yes, again, it's not clear.
We never actually find out what happened to Dad. But he has the other half of the ring, and that contains his last message, and that gives them the coordinates they need.
That gives them the coordinates. So, yes, then we're on to the... Well, then it goes really bonkers, because then they have to go through a black hole or a time warp or something of that nature.
This is not a serious science fiction film, let's be fair.
It's not to do with relativistic speeds or anything. It's just that... If you deviate from the course, time will move much more rapidly.
Well, it does anyway, but if you go off the course, you'll be stuck there forever.
Yes.
Or I suppose one could read that as your ship will be spat out 600 years of subjective time later when everybody's dead or whatever.
Except that they actually age more quickly, so it's not really subject. It doesn't make a lot of sense as far as Einsteinian physics goes, because subjectively your time, anyway, it doesn't matter. They are ambushed by the villain, Zorn, Jeremy West, who, again, he's quite a distinctive character, but... again, he's kind of an imperious wizard, I suppose, in the sense of this kind of film. But he's been sort of looking pissed off on and off throughout the rest of the film.
Yeah, his basic job is to look as if he's just smelled something bad.
Yes, exactly, and he does that very well. On the way, obviously, we finally get Jason and the princess coming together, shall we say,
before the time distortion kicks in.
Yes, in every sense of the word, which becomes relevant because they are then amber. And again, it's a nice little scene. It's a nice little seduction scene.
Yeah, there is this fight through the ship as everybody is getting older, except the robots, obviously.
Yeah, so they get ambushed by the villain, Zorn, Jeremy West, and then they... They're slightly knocked off course or something, which means they all start rapidly getting older.
Roscoe in a huge white fro. I mean, it's obvious, but it works.
They get longer and longer beards, and they get and then they are eventually. So there's a huge battle on board the ship. Everyone's struggling because they're all getting more and more arthritis. There are some deaths amongst the crew. The villains are mostly robots, so they're less affected by the aging. But fortunately, because Robert Urich planted his seed in the princess, his son, she rapidly gives birth, and his son comes of age and rescues him as his own swashbuckling pirate.
While the battle is still going on.
Which means that they get through the time warp, and it prevents that whole future from happening, and they can all remember it. So basically they reset back to where they were. But
except that the Templar ship has been knocked off course and is now gone.
We do not know where, but will not be back. And yes, they are at Earth. And that's where our film ends. There's so much, you know, it reminds me a bit of, The Star's My Destination, the Alfred Bester film, which every Alfred Bester book, in that book, every single chapter has got so many ideas in it and is so different from the one before. I just got, like, you could have made a book about every one of those. And this film feels a bit like that. They've just thrown perhaps not as intelligently as Alfred Bester, to be fair, but they've just thrown absolutely everything into it. They, as you say, there's an Alien parody, there's a Mad Max parody, there's even kind of, jokey parodies of the sort of 70s po-faced kind of, like the Decadent Planet is sort of a bit akin to the Logan's Run planet where, well, as you say, I mean, it looks identical. There's a bit of sort of nods to Star Wars. But it all fits in because it's just that kind of world. I don't know how they do it. It's, as I say, the film is bordering on bad because it's so densely plotted and so complicated silly.
Well, I've seen this sometimes in first novels where the author clearly wants to get all their ideas into the book, and sometimes there is too much stuff to fit in the book and no individual bit gets enough treatment. And there's a bit of that here, I think.
There is, but I think what carries it through is just... we like the characters and we like spending time with them and seeing them in these different, I don't know. I think that's what saves it for me, that despite all the craziness and all the different perspectives and everything like that, it's first and foremost, it wants you to care about these classic kind of romantic film, black and white kind of swashbuckling heroes. And so they're at the forefront of everything.
I'm half sold already at that point.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm a big fan of the classic pirate films.
It's a throwback to that sensibility with this kind of gonzo jamming everything in. So we talked, it wasn't that long ago that we talked about Condor Man and how it had a pretty low target, but to me it missed it. Do you feel this is a similar thing here?
I would absolutely agree that it's not aiming high. It's not trying to be, you know, the film that changes everything the way Alien did.
It's not
did.
The Seventh Seal, is it?
But it hits square on. It's trying to be entertaining. It utterly succeeds, as far as I'm concerned, in being entertaining.
100%. I couldn't agree more with that. Just
I'm not really using the masterpiece metric anymore, but I am using. Would I recommend that you seek this out, you random listener whom I know nothing about? All right, I'm thinking about one or two specific people whom I know do listen, but in general, yes, I would.
Yeah, I would say to the people who I've spoken to my friends, who saw this once when they were teenagers and never wanted to visit again because they were worried it was crap, I would reassure you it is not crap. It's still just as joyful and silly as it was when you're a teenager. Did I enjoy it less than I did as a I probably enjoyed it more as a teenager just because it was just perfect. Well, I don't think that's true. I think I enjoyed it just as much this time as well.
Remembering Escape from New York, which influenced a lot of what would now be called geek culture. It was certainly, elements of that were in a lot of role-playing games I played, even though I hadn't seen the film.
Yes.
I think this did too. On a smaller scale, because not as many people saw it, but it certainly influenced the games I ran.
Yeah, exactly. It was either influenced it or very familiar to us in that it was just, I mean, again, this came out when I was 8. This was a time when videos would then come out from the film a year or more later. So I probably didn't see this till I was, it probably languished in the video shop. So I guess I probably saw it when I was 10 or 11, which I think is probably pretty good age to see this sort of film. But I would, if you want entertainment from a film and you like swashbuckling films, I agree. This is, and you like 80s sci-fi, this is going to hit all the things for you. As far as masterpiece goes, I want to call it a masterpiece because it is, to me, the pinnacle of that form of 80s sci-fi.
It absolutely does what it sets out to do.
Yes. I suppose that I might hold back in the sense that it's not terribly original, but I think it's close. It's very close because it just does... It exactly hits... I'm not sure... I think they must have been consciously aiming for the target that they hit, because it just does it perfectly. I feel like I'm being too effusive over this film, but it's lovely. I would watch this again. That's one of my metrics of masterpiece. Would I watch it again after it finished? Maybe not immediately, but I wouldn't mind seeing this again quite soon. I wonder if I should show it to my son. You might like this. Maybe it's a bit too gonzo for him at the minute. But anyway, I loved it. Yeah, I have very little bad to say about it. I am very sorry that it didn't make huge stars out of Robert Urich, Mary Crosby, Michael Roberts. But it was great. More of that, please. They just don't make them like this anymore. Blimey, I'm getting old.
So where did you make the robot black?
I had to make him perfect. It's full of those little sides. I love it. Good. Okay.